There are very few things that investors can do that are free. But what about a podcast that delivers educational content on investing, saving strategies, financial planning, topical items of interest, and maybe even the odd wacky topic? Welcome to Free Lunch, hosted by the CM Group. Free Lunch will bring listeners the team's vast knowledge and experience in dealing with uncertainty to help clients achieve their vision through a deep understanding of what is important to them that requires planning, money, and time. Learn more and subscribe today at markets-work.com.
Welcome back to the Free Lunch Podcast with Greg and Colin. Greg, last week we took some time to look back at the first 200 episodes of the Free Lunch Podcast.
Yeah.
That was fun to look back at everything we've done over the last 4 years. And I can't believe we're over 200 episodes already.
Yeah, that's a good milestone. Looking forward to 300.
Yeah, here's to the next 200 and beyond. So for today's podcast, I have a question for you. Do you remember the company called Groupon?
I remember it. I never used it, but I remember it.
We used to use it all the time. We used to buy these coupons on Groupon that just got you discounts to restaurants or activities. But I haven't seen them in a while. So the question is, what happened to all the Groupons? Do you know?
I have no idea.
I don't really either, but I did look it up online, on the line.
Yes.
On the interweb,
as you like to say.
The World Wide Web. And according to Statista, which is a statistical database, in 2014, at its peak, there were 54 million people using Groupon regularly.
Sounds successful.
Yeah, but in the first half of 2023, so almost a year ago, that had dropped down to 17 million people.
Wow.
So a drop of close to 70%.
Yep.
But I guess the question is why? Like, where did all these people go that were using Groupon? What happened to Groupon? And I think it's that Groupon was simply a first-to-market company. They had what's called a first-mover advantage.
Right.
It's been seen many times in many different industries over the years, but being first-to-market doesn't mean that the company has the strength to stay relevant in that market. There's other forces that come into play. And since Groupon was first introduced, there's been many new market entrants. And so for Groupon, these new companies or competitors would be like examples, Living Social, Travelzoo, something called Amazon. I'm sure you've heard of that.
Oh, yeah.
Amazon Local.
Yep.
Yelp, Crowd Savings, Pound It. There's a whole list of them. I won't list them all off. There's probably 20 or 25 that could easily be called out. So I guess the question is, how is this playing out now? Like, how is this relevant to today's market? We look at things like NVIDIA, for example.
Yep.
NVIDIA has captured so much market share over the last 6 months. It's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have Tesla, Apple. Are these the next Groupons? Like, what can they do to not be Groupon?
Or Netscape.
Netscape, yeah, that's one. Lycos.
Yeah.
Remember Lycos?
Oh, man. You know what? It's too easy because there are so many of those examples. And for NVIDIA, at the time of this recording, that stock had hit a high this year of $974. It's now trading around $893, so that's about a 10% drop. And that could have been for many reasons, right? And so does this mean that it'll become the next Groupon? I would think not, because certainly they've carved out a very large chunk of a very developing market, that being artificial intelligence. So it may not become the next Groupon, but it does show that competition is fierce. They're in the generative AI space, and AI is getting all the headlines these days, and with good reason. And so our world is changing dramatically and with the power of AI. But again, what does it mean specifically for NVIDIA? This will play out in the future. So the big competitors with NVIDIA are AMD and Intel. Mm-hmm. Intel is building a massive new plant in the U.S.
I think in Phoenix, if I'm not...
That's right, in Arizona.
Yeah,
it's a public-private partnership, as it turns out. And Intel, they make chips. They make a lot of them, and we don't know whether they'll be a successful competitor to NVIDIA or if NVIDIA will just basically retain the market. Other examples, Tesla had a first mover advantage big time, and they were the first one out really with all electric vehicles on a large scale. But the premiums on Tesla vehicles have eroded since the expansion of EVs from other manufacturers. And now every automaker in the world is now focusing on electric vehicles. Mm-hmm. Tesla stock hit a high of $299 this year, and it's trading at about $171 now, a drop of over 40%. Apple, and you and I are both self-described big fans of Apple.
Well, you just got an Apple Watch.
I just got myself an Apple Watch.
Welcome to the club.
Thanks. It's nice to be a member. So much competition in that space, it would be ridiculous to think that one company can keep as much market share as Apple has been able to capture forever. You know, Apple makes up about 3% of the world stock market capitalization. So that's pretty large. The entire Canadian economy also makes up 3% of the world's market cap. So Apple stock, $199 earlier this year, and has since fallen to $176, a drop of almost 12%.
I find it amazing that Apple, not just Apple market cap is the same as the entire Canadian economy, but Microsoft is basically the same, and NVIDIA is basically the same.
Yeah, market cap of NVIDIA is now over $1 trillion.
Yeah, so those three companies provide three times the size of the entire Canadian market.
Absolutely, yeah. And listen, these stocks are all down quite a bit this year. Now, they were up quite a bit last year, so maybe that's to be expected. But during the same period when these stocks have now taken a breather, the S&P 500 is trading at an all-time high, 5,200 points. So it's up about 24% in the last 12 months. So why are we talking about this? I mean, I guess is the question. And the reason is that it's easy for people to get caught up in, they make a projection based on what's happened recently. Tesla's, they're going to take over the global car market. And albeit they've grown very quickly, but lots of other competitors out there. NVIDIA just going to keep going up because a huge optimistic outlook for artificial intelligence. But we want people not to focus on making projections about a particular stock into the future, because we know lots of stuff can happen to various companies. And you've done some work on this yourself over the years when you're doing your MBA and subsequently. So,
well, you see another real life example playing out right now. There was an airline called Lynx.
Oh, yes.
It's no longer in existence.
Yeah.
It was just squeezed out by competition.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So I first ran across something called Porter's Five Forces was when I was doing my MBA, and Michael Porter published Porter's Five Forces way back in 1979 in a little rag called the Harvard Business Review.
Oh, yes.
It remains a fundamental tool for analysts plotting the competitive landscape of an industry. So there's a lot of competition in industries, and Porter set out five forces that are at play in any given industry. The first one being internal competition. The second one being the potential for new entrants. Number three is the negotiating power of suppliers. Number four, the negotiating power of customers. And number five, the ability of customers to find substitutes. So strategic analysis at the time of Porter's article tended not only to love acronyms like SWOT, PEST, PESTEL, etc., which we're not going to get into all those things. But for example, SWOT is a strength, weakness, opportunity, threat analysis that any company can do, but also models focused on the internal dynamics of individual companies. So it would be unfair to suggest they ignored the competitive environment companies face. They're typically vague while doing so. Example, the opportunities and threats of SWOT analysis may be too macro for many dealing with challenges of specific industries. Like if you think of Tesla, for example, it's just too macro, right? Like if every automaker in the world is now focused on electric vehicles, what specific threat is it to Tesla? I mean, the threat is an all-encompassing threat, right?
For sure.
So Porter's 1979 article was also a broadside against the theoretical models found in the curriculum of most major business schools, where future strategists dealt with a perfectly competitive market, which they characterized by equilibrium and no specific firm influencing prices. So they're saying not any one company can influence the price, right?
Yeah.
So this is a model they're unlikely to find in the real world, right? So I have a big problem with this when you go through school and you go through, like I remember being in a corporate finance class and the prof saying, well, stocks are priced based off of the dividend discount model. And I was like, well, maybe, like in theory, but then there's something called momentum that comes into play. Absolutely. At times and has nothing to do with the dividend discount model. So there's theoretical and then there's applied or realistic. So for today's podcast, we're just trying to understand Porter's five forces and how they might play out in things like NVIDIA, Tesla, GameStop,
yep,
or whatever, right?
For sure.
So the first sentence of the article was pretty controversial. It says, the essence of strategy formulation is coping with competition. The second sentence is also consequential. It says, yet it is easy to view competition too narrowly and too pessimistically. So what Porter suggests is rather than viewing competition narrowly as rivalry among existing competitors, his first force, Porter expands on the concept to include the four others, which is the bargaining power of suppliers, the threat of new entrants, the threat of substitute products and services. So let's just take these in turn and kind of go through each one. We won't beat it to death, but this is just to, I don't know, make people aware.
There won't be a test after or anything like that.
No, no test. We've already taken those tests. We don't need to deliver tests.
Yep.
So what did you take us through number one, Greg?
Well, sure. And his first force is usually what we mean when we're discussing business competition. So you can think of Pepsi and Coca-Cola for soft drinks, Apple and Samsung for smartphones, Nike and Adidas for sneakers, Ford and General Motors for autos. And some of those rivalries are so influential that consumers split almost culturally among those who have an iPhone, drive a Ford, or prefer Netflix to Hulu or something. So it's no accident that we're considering business competition chiefly as a war among rivals. And those kinds of rivalries can lead to price wars or high-priced marketing battles and races for slight advances that could mean a competitive advantage. And those tactics could actually stimulate companies to make even better products, but also erode profits and market stability. So let's just talk a little bit about internal competition a little deeper. Several factors can contribute to the intensity of a competitive rivalry in an industry. So number one would be the number of competitors. Obviously, the more competitors in an industry, the more fierce the rivalry, and each one will be fighting for scraps of market share. And that's, you see, playing out in the electric vehicle market right now. I mean, Tesla certainly had first mover advantage, but also every car maker in the world is now making them. And in fact, I was reading that BYD, the Chinese electric vehicle maker, just exceeded Tesla sales, I think, for the last couple of quarters. So absolutely. But the number of competitors is huge.
It's like BYD, not BYOB.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Industry growth, right? So in an expanding industry, competition is usually less dramatic because the market is growing so fast that competitors have little need to fight for customers. And that actually happened in the automobile industry the last time, early in the 20th century, and of course the dot-com boom of the late 90s. There's similarities in what's offered. So when the products or services are very similar, competition tends to be intense because customers can easily switch. But if a company offers any kind of unique product or service, then they can earn brand loyalty. And so Apple certainly comes to mind in tech goods. So there's that. Exit barriers. It can be difficult or costly for companies to leave the industry because of their specialized assets or contractual obligations or even emotional attachments. They may stay and compete even if their prospects are growing dimmer by the day. And the airline industry is a classic example of that because they have high costs, contractual obligations, and regulatory requirements. So even in a shrinking market, they're still playing the game. And lastly, fixed costs. So Porter notes that if an industry has high fixed costs, companies have a strong temptation to cut prices rather than slow production when demand slackens. And things like paper and aluminum manufacturing are good examples of that.
Sure. And number two would be the potential for new entrants in an industry. I mean, we see this in our industry. There's nothing to stop somebody from becoming an investment advisor,
absolutely,
right? Like it's, I mean, there's certain licensing requirements that you need to do, but it's not like you have to go to grad school for it. So industries where new firms can enter more easily almost always have lower profit margins, and the firms involved in each have potentially less market share. So think of like the sector for local restaurants. I mean, if you were to want to open up a restaurant, there's relatively low entry requirements. You just have to find a space and, I don't know, buy a fryer and hire a cook.
Or buy all the equipment from a restaurant that had previously been there and gone out of business.
Yeah, we've seen a few of those over the years, right? So there's no significant investments or regulatory hurdles to opening that type of business to the public. It's also the case that your favorite restaurant may not stay open for long, as you've mentioned. So given the hyper-competitive environment, constant entrance of new restaurants opening, I mean, you can just walk through different food courts and you can, over time, see the different ones that used to be there, right? So here are some factors in measuring how much new entrants threaten an industry. First would be economies of scale. So industries where large scale of production leads to lower costs face less of a threat of new entrants, right? Product differentiation. So when existing firms have strong brand identities or customer loyalty, it's harder for new entrants to gain market share. This might be the Lynx example, actually, although there was a large capital requirements when you're going into this type of business. So high startup costs for equipment, facilities that can deter new entrants. access to distribution channels. So if existing firms control the distribution channels, such as retail stores, online platforms, cable infrastructure, etc. Where I think of this is like, we pay so much for our Wi-Fi and cell products in Canada. There's only so many, I don't know, satellites and lines to use, right?
Yeah.
And so if you wanted to start a new cell phone company, you would have to negotiate for the infrastructure with those that own the infrastructure.
Exactly.
And they're probably not going to give you that much access. There's regulations, so licenses, safety standards, regulatory standards, those can create barriers. And then there's switching costs. So if it's costly or difficult for customers to switch from, let's say, TELUS to Shaw as an example, that's just an example. I'm not suggesting people switch from TELUS to Shaw or Shaw to TELUS.
Absolutely not.
As a matter of fact, Shaw is not Shaw anymore. It's now Rogers, right? Yeah,
true.
So, but the point is, if the cost is a lot to switch, you're not going to gain a lot of market share.
Right on. Yeah. The third force is supplier power. So suppliers are powerful when they're the only source of something important that a firm needs. They can differentiate their product or have strong brands. So when the power of suppliers in an industry is high, this raises costs or otherwise limits the resources a firm needs. So here's some of the factors used to measure the supplier power of an industry. First one being the number of suppliers. So when few firms can give a company something it needs to stay in business, each has greater negotiating power. They can raise prices or reduce quality without fear of losing business.
So this actually feeds right into the NVIDIA story right now. And the fact that, as you mentioned, there's other people that are building plants.
That's right, because NVIDIA right now is one of the few suppliers to the whole generative AI industry. Okay, so number of suppliers, number one, the uniqueness. So if a supplier provides a unique product or it's not easy to find a substitute, it's more dominant. Again, the NVIDIA example for now. In that case, businesses can't easily switch to another supplier. Switching costs. So it might be costly or time consuming to switch suppliers. Then the existing suppliers have more power and businesses are less likely to switch even if prices increase. There's forward integration. So if suppliers can move into the buyer's industry, they have more power. They already have access to the necessary supplies, making it difficult for their former buyers to compete once they decide to enter the market themselves. And lastly, industry importance. So some sectors are tightly intertwined, such as automotive suppliers and the major auto companies, or the semiconductor and tech industries, which we're talking about a lot these days. And that can help balance the power between suppliers and those in the sector. And it's because the supplier needs these buyers to do well so that it can too. When a supplier can just as easily sell its products elsewhere, that gives it a great deal more power.
Yeah, exactly. So now there's going to be a lot of commonality between these things. Like you mentioned switching costs for supplier power. I mentioned switching costs also for potential for new entrants in an industry. Like those are just things that are going to be in different areas of each force, right?
Yes, for sure.
So number four we're going to talk about from Porter is customer power. So when customers have more strength, they can exert pressure on businesses to provide better products or services at lower prices. So this force intensifies under certain conditions. So the first one being the number of buyers. If there's not a lot of buyers, they have more power. So if you think of like sectors like aerospace manufacturing, each major airline, the industry's customers have significant leverage in negotiations. Think about what's happening at Boeing right now.
Yeah.
Right? There's a lot of issues about product safety.
Yep.
And that's going to come back to hurt Boeing's prices because there's only so many people that buy $100 million planes.
Exactly.
Right? Yep. I don't even know if a plane's $100 million. Do you know?
I have no idea.
I think it's multiples of hundreds of millions. We're going to have to look that up offline. Okay,
yeah. We'll answer that question next time.
I know I'm not buying my own plane.
No.
So that was what I know. Purchase size. So just like you head off to big box stores to buy in bulk for cheaper per unit costs, I mean, major retail chains do the same. Walmart buys in large volumes and they can negotiate better terms and discounts than you can as an individual consumer. There's switching costs, just like you mentioned before. So in industries like telecommunications, where it's easy for consumers to switch providers, companies have to offer competitive terms. And that's where you see things like, hey, sign up with us for a 2-year program and we'll give you a free iPad or whatever, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Just price sensitivity. So think of the fast fashion industry where customers are highly price sensitive brands must keep their prices low to attract cost-conscious consumers.
Right on. Right? Yeah.
And there's informed buyers. So in many sectors, the customers are savvy. They know the competitive terrain well, and they can negotiate better prices.
Yeah, right on. And the fifth force, which is a really interesting one, is the threat of substitutes. So when a customer can find substitutes for a sector's services, that's a major threat to the companies in that industry. And there's some ways that threat can be magnified. So first, relative price performance. So if the cost of a substitute is lower and its performance is comparable or better, customers are likely to switch to the substitute. And we saw that with streaming services like Netflix, which became a substitute for traditional cable TV and provided a lower price that threatened the cable industry. And I think it's safe to say that many of us watch very little on cable these days. We stream most of our shows, and I'm not 100% sure why I'm still paying for cable, but I am.
You know what? I only pay for cable for the sports.
Yeah.
And I know that you don't watch a lot of sports.
Not a lot.
But no. I do. And actually, like, the cable companies aren't dumb. They know that there's reasons why you have subscriptions, right? And so now they're starting to come out with subscription services for sports as a package. So in the future, you may be able to not have a cable bill, but I don't know if you're going to save any money, because between all the subscription services, it's probably the same amount.
Well, for example, in my particular case, and again, not a recommendation, just a fact, with my cable package that I pay for, I get Crave, which you could subscribe for Crave separately, and they just happen to build that into the price of the incredibly expensive cable package I pay for.
Yeah. Wait, but do you have 4 Amazon subscriptions?
No, I don't.
Okay, then you're saving.
No, not yet. Okay, so we're talking about threat of substitutes. Second one is the customer willingness to go elsewhere. So the threat is high if buyers find it easy to switch to a substitute. So back in the early 2010s, customers found switching from taxis to ride-sharing apps like Uber or Lyft were chipper and easier. I was an original one. Oh, I didn't know what to think of Uber. We don't have Lyft here yet, but didn't know what to think about it. And now it's so easy to call up an Uber rather than to try to remember the number for the taxi.
Yeah. But it is a little freaky, right? You know, like, you grow up and your parents tell you, don't get into cars with strangers.
Yes.
And now you're sending your kids in Ubers in cars with strangers.
It is a little freaky. That's right. And that's a different discussion. Okay. The sense that products are similar. So if buyers perceive that there are actually relatively few differences between your product and substitute, even if there are, they might be more likely to switch. Or the availability of close substitutes. So it sounds a little bit like the previous point, but you have to kind of strategize differently around it. So there's times when potential substitutes are very different from a company's products, but consumers still treat them as the same. But in other cases, there are genuinely similar products in the market and the threat of substitutes is high, such as between brand name and generic medications. So all of these things certainly show strengths and weaknesses and risks to companies and their position in the market.
For sure. Well, the bottom line, let's talk about that. Let's, in other words, call it the conclusion. Porter's Five Forces model does set out essential criteria when you're considering a company's competitive landscape. So whether that's NVIDIA, Tesla, Apple, GameStop, Uber, whatever, yep. Right? Yep. The power of suppliers and buyers, the threat of new entrants and substitutes, the competitive rivalry. So the economic terrain has evolved a lot since Porter first published this. I imagine back in 1979, nobody was looking at generative AI as one of those threats. But the principles remain current. So it's still the case that companies don't rise and fall on their portfolio of products alone, but are jockeying with others in industries that have their own logic and structural forces at play. So whether that's in the airline industry with the recent collapse of Lynx, or as you mentioned, new people producing more things to compete with NVIDIA's market share. If I think of our industry, every year, parent companies, i.e. banks, come out with targets. They want to grow their market share by, I don't know, 5% a year or something. Pick a number. Well, the question I've always had is, how does everybody in the market grow their market share by 5%? Where does it come from? It can't. So today, while the Five Forces model may require adapting to rapid technology change that you mentioned, and the importance of collaboration across many industries, it's definitely still a reliable way to help guide companies needing to navigate industry-specific challenges in their competitive strategy. And this is just going to carry on forever.
Well, and I think it highlights, and to sort of bring it home to some of the lessons that we've learned over the years and have talked about on our previous 200 podcasts, to try to look at companies and make some sort of prediction about what their success or failure might look like in the future. Not only does it take an analysis of every individual company, the way companies themselves should be looking at their own businesses, but to do that, to make predictions about the company's position in the marketplace, the growth of the sector or the industry that they're operating in, trying to make those kinds of predictions would be impossible. Okay, and many analysts are out there taking on individual companies or sectors and trying to do that. But with all of those forces at play, the odds of being able to correctly predict the future for a particular company or sector, incredibly difficult. And so from an investment standpoint, let the markets do what they do, let Porter's five forces affect companies and industries the way they will, and we'll benefit by being broadly diversified in portfolios of companies that represent the full range. You know, so it's an interesting analysis. And when you just spend time thinking about those five forces, it makes you look at the companies or the industries that you think are guaranteed to be successful in the future and maybe question that a little bit.
Yeah, like Groupon's gone, essentially. Where did Blockbuster go? Netflix used to be a provider of DVDs that had to change its corporate structure because of all these powers, right?
BlackBerry was the first mover in handheld technology.
Nortel.
Whatever happened to the Palm?
The Palm.
You know?
I used to have a Palm.
Is it Palm Pilot
Palm
or something.
Pilot. I had a Palm. Yeah. I loved it.
Yeah, right on.
And I loved my BlackBerry at the time. But things change. Like even when you look at the S&P 500, the 500 largest stocks that trade in the United States, a majority of them weren't in the S&P 500 30 years ago.
That's right.
Right? So there's been evolution in different industries. There's been companies that have merged or failed. That's just the way it goes.
Right on.
So those leaders today, good for them.
Yep.
Probably aren't going to be, or there's a high likelihood, they won't have the same market share or be the same leaders 30 years from now.
That's right.
There'll be new leaders, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You heard it here first.
I'll be looking forward to seeing who the new leaders are 30 years from now.
Well, that's our next episode.
Okay.
30 companies to invest in for the next 30 years.
Perfect.
All right. Well, I guess that wraps it up for today.
You bet.
Okay.
Until next time.
Thank you for listening to the Free Lunch Podcast hosted by the CM Group. To subscribe to this podcast to get more realistic insights on investing or to connect with one of our talented partners, please head on over to markets-work.com. We'll see you next time on the Free Lunch Podcast. The CIBC logo and CIBC Private Wealth are registered trademarks of CIBC. If you are currently a CIBC Wood Gundy client, please contact your investment advisor. CIBC Private Wealth consists of services provided by CIBC and its subsidiaries, including CIBC Wood Gundy, a division of CIBC World Markets, Inc. CIBC Private Wealth is a registered trademark of CIBC used under license. Wood Gundy is a registered trademark of CIBC World Markets, Inc. Colin Andrews and Greg Kaminsky are investment advisors with CIBC Wood Gundy. This information, including any opinion, is based on various sources believed to be reliable, but its accuracy cannot be guaranteed and is subject to change. CIBC and CIBC World Markets, Inc., their affiliates, directors, officers, and employees may buy, sell, or hold a position in securities of a company mentioned herein, its affiliates, or subsidiaries, and may also perform financial advisory services, investment banking, or other services for or have lending or other credit relationships with the same. CIBC World Markets, Inc. and its representatives will receive sales commissions and or a spread between bid and ask prices if you purchase, sell, or hold the securities referred to above. CIBC World Markets, Inc. 2024.